Hi, I'm Michelle Shepard, host of Uncover Sharmini from CBC Podcasts. In 1999, 15-year-old Sharmini Anandaville disappeared on her way to a job that police believed didn't exist. 4 months later, her remains were found in a wooded ravine. I revisit the case that has stayed with me for over 20 years, ever since I first covered it as a cub crime reporter for the Toronto Star. You can find Uncover Sharmini on CBC Listen or on your favorite podcast app.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Helen Mann.
And I'm Lisa Bryn Rundle. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition.
Tonight, stopping the presses. Today marks a full year since Russian authorities detained U.S. journalist Evan Gerskovich. We reached the New York Times Moscow bureau chief, who knows it easily could have been him instead.
Hoops and prayers. Calgary basketball player Yvonne Ejim is making her mark on March Madness. Her former coach tells us he knew from the start that she was something special.
Designated survivor. A jiu-jitsu instructor in BC has a long recovery ahead after a horrific car crash captured on a hard-to-watch surveillance video. But he says he is just happy no one else got hurt.
A real bright spot. If you're not into donning protective glasses to enjoy a celestial phenomenon, you might want to set your sights on another rare occurrence on the horizon, and also above the horizon, because this one you can see with your naked eyes.
Going whole hog. The UK loves their hedgehogs, but the spiky creatures are seeing a dramatic drop in numbers. Now human spotters are getting help from artificial intelligence to nail down what's got the beloved creatures in such a prickle.
And putting your house in odor, researchers dig into why children smell the way they do, as their bouquet develops from floral newborns to goat-like teens. As It Happens, the Friday edition, radio that adds its own 2 cents. If you look at the front page of the Wall Street Journal today, you'll see a whole lot of nothing. And in this case, it's what's missing that counts. Above a large square of blank space sits Evan Gerskovich's byline, and the headline, "His Story Should Be Here." Today marks 1 year since Mr. Gerskovich, a correspondent for the Journal, was arrested by Russian authorities and accused of espionage. He's the first American reporter to be held on such charges in decades. Anton Troyanovsky is the Moscow bureau chief for the New York Times. He's also a friend and former colleague of Mr. Gerskovich. We reached him in Berlin.
Anton, how did you mark today, the one-year anniversary of Evan's arrest?
Well, it's definitely a sad day, but one that we want to use, we as friends and colleagues of Evan, to look ahead and just remind everyone of how critical this case is to press freedom worldwide. I'm based in Berlin now, where a lot of friends and colleagues of Evan's from Moscow have relocated to after the start of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And today we went to the Brandenburg Gate and held up a big banner that said "Free Evan."
What did that feel like, just to be among your colleagues sharing that moment?
That's really, in this really difficult time, it's been really important to be around folks who you can share that with.
You've known Evan for a number of years. Tell us a bit about your first impressions. What struck you when you first met him?
Yeah, well, I met Evan, I think it was the very early 2018. I had just arrived in Moscow as the new bureau chief for the Washington Post, and he had just arrived in Moscow as someone who had been working as a clerk in the newsroom of the New York Times and actually quit that job to be able to come to Russia and try his hand at being a foreign correspondent. Evan, you know, grew up in a Russian-speaking immigrant household in the United States, just like I did. And so we immediately bonded over that. I could see that Evan had this incredible energy and curiosity to learn everything he could about Russia and its people and to tell that story.
Evan is still awaiting trial on these charges. Earlier this week, as you know, a Russian court extended his detention for another 3 months. Tell us what message you think the court is trying to send by pushing back the start of this trial.
Well, I can tell you just as a Russia correspondent, the court does not have any agency here. Vladimir Putin himself has made it clear publicly, most recently in his February interview with Tucker Carlson, that he sees Evan as a negotiating chip, as a hostage, essentially. He wants to get a good deal, some kind of a prisoner exchange, most likely, with the West. So Peter Carstens, the State Department official in charge of these hostage negotiations, said that he hopes that this new 90-day period can be used to work out some kind of agreement with Russia. I know it will be difficult, but clearly the U.S. government is working on this, and hopefully this will get resolved sooner rather than later.
Evan's family have begun to advocate more vocally for his release, and that includes his sister Danielle. I want to play you a part of what she told my colleague, CBC's Rosemary Barton.
I'm in awe of my brother. He's working very hard to keep his spirits up. I saw the recent courtroom footage from the last hearing, and it's incredible to see him smile. And we write letters to each other weekly, and he's still my little brother teasing me. I'm just so amazed by how well he's holding up.
When you hear about the efforts Evan is making to hold things together, to stay in touch with people and maintain his spirits, his family, of course, maintain theirs too. What goes through your mind?
It's incredible. I mean, look, it's also not surprising. I mean, Evan just has this incredible strength of spirit and character. And he understood that when he went to Russia to report last year, he was doing so at some risk. And frankly, I understood that too when I was reporting from Russia. You know, this is an authoritarian state where there is no rule of law, where anything can happen. But he also understood that this was an incredibly important story, an incredibly important job that he was doing, you know, covering, explaining to the world what was really happening in a country that had launched the invasion of Ukraine. So what I see, you know, and I get letters from Evan too every few weeks, what I see is that he's holding up. He's keeping his spirits up. He's trying to keep the spirits up of his family and also of his friends. You know, he still in these letters keeps that acerbic wit that he had when he was a free man. He's really interested in what's going on in the world and among his friends and colleagues. So he's really staying strong.
You are among so many people who are exchanging letters with him, including strangers. Can you just tell us what kind of conversations you have through the mail?
Yeah, so that's right. Anyone can send a letter to him. You just write to freegershkovich@gmail.com, and his friends will actually translate those letters into Russian, as required by law there, and mail them. We talk about what's going on in life, in the newspaper industry. I myself used to work at the Wall Street Journal, so yeah, we just talk about what's going on. I think that kind of maybe almost idle conversation, I think, is really important to keep him connected to the outside world.
I understand you talk a lot about things that I suppose he's missing, like the kind of foods and drinks that you might share.
Exactly. We do. I remember telling him about going to Mexico City last year and some of the food I had there. And he responded with his memories about going to Mexico City. And he, Evan himself, used to work at a restaurant in New York. So he's actually very interested in food. He taught me how to properly cook a steak when we were both living in Moscow. So it's a lot of stuff like that.
You know, as a fellow journalist who has covered the same ground, had a similar life experience as you've outlined to us, do you at times put yourself in his place and just think how you might cope in a similar situation?
Completely. I mean, this really is something that could have happened to me or to any of my colleagues, because this is a line that in theory could have crossed at any moment. So I think about that a lot. you know, first of all, I know that if this happened to me, Evan would be supporting me just the same, if not more. It absolutely does cross my mind.
Anton, I hope you get to share a steak you're making together sometime soon and a drink and lots of gossip again in person. So thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on Evan today. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Anton Troenovsky is the Moscow bureau chief for the New York Times and a friend of Evan Gerskovich. We reached him in Berlin. And you can hear the full conversation with his sister, Danielle Gerskovich, on Rosemary Barton Live this Sunday on CBC TV and CBC News Network. David Brune's list of injuries is long, but the Victoria, BC jiu-jitsu instructor says he's lucky to be alive. On Wednesday night, earlier this month, the 34-year-old was driving home and was T-boned. Video footage from the scene shows a car going through a red light at the intersection, sending Mr. Brune's silver pickup truck crashing into a city bus with people on board. Mr. Brune has been discharged from the hospital now and is recovering at home. We reached him in Victoria.
David, how are you feeling right now?
I take it day by day. I've got maybe an hour or two of good energy in me before I'm more or less tapped out. I find the concussion is usually what catches up with me.
Right. What are your injuries at this point?
I have, I think, at least two or three fractures in my C1 vertebra, one on the back and one on the right side. I've got some pretty serious whiplash. I've got a concussion, temporal concussion, lost my memory of the event and a couple of the days after. Things kind of come back to me Friday morning, and the accident happened Wednesday night last week. I also had internal organ bleeding, my right kidney, my right lung, and my adrenal gland all had lacerations from the twisting and from the impact of the accident that were bleeding internally, but it's since resolved. But those will keep me away from being able to lift weights or work or do anything strenuous or return to sport for a minimum of 6 months just because of the danger of re-bleeding.
Did you require surgery?
No, I was very lucky. I'm in a neck brace, and I'll be in a neck brace for at least 3 months. But for most of my injuries, I was just able to rest and was able to avoid surgery.
Are you able to walk around?
Yeah, I can walk around, but the accident definitely worsened a pre-existing injury I had in my knee. I had a torn meniscus that used to get aggravated after maybe 5 or 6 floors of stairs, and now gets aggravated after 5 or 6 stairs.
Right.
So it's, but that's also in the works for being taken care of eventually. They can't operate right away because they have to put you under for the surgery for that. And at the moment, with my neck compromised, they wouldn't be able to intubate or do any of the usual things that they would need to put you under for surgery.
I see.
So that'll have to happen after I'm healed up from the rest of this.
I have to say, I actually gasped when I first looked at that footage. What is it like for you when you see the images of that accident?
Well, I'm not very squeamish. I was a butcher for a while before I got into trades. So for me, watching it, it kind of was like watching it happen to someone else. And if anything, the impact is just so impressive to see, like the way that the vehicle spins around through the intersection, the way that the back end just atomizes from the impact with the front of the bus.
Yeah, honestly, basically your truck kind of just shattered, right?
Yeah, there's basically just a front end of it left. Honestly, looking at the whole thing, it's kind of a little awe-inspiring that happened and that somehow I survived that. And I'm just glad that we all made it out alive.
Yeah, you know, when you look at it, you realize how much worse things could have been for everybody, but particularly for you. And I'm just thinking sometimes when people have close calls, I mean, I'm aware of this myself, you replay it in your mind a lot afterwards, how close you came to something so much more catastrophic. Are you playing it in your mind?
Well, I definitely asked myself, is there anything that I could have done to avoid it? But the thing about that corner is what you would do to avoid that is, as you approach an intersection and you have the green light, you slow down a little and you check both sides of oncoming traffic just to make sure no one's about to try to blow a red light and run through you. The problem with that corner is that on the left, as I was approaching, heading up Bay, and it would have been on the left that I would have potentially been able to see something coming. There's a very tall, large, looks like a concrete building that kind of makes that corner a blind corner. You wouldn't really be able to see anything until you're already in the intersection and it's too late. You know, that's about as far as I got in terms of trying to think of what I could have done different. The other thing, too, is I don't have memory of the impact or the incident. So I don't know, I don't have the, oh, no, I need to avoid this kind of memory. Like, I don't remember the headlights coming. I don't remember the impact. I just remember driving home after cleaning up shop at Van Al Jiu-Jitsu and locking up and everything. And then I wake up in the hospital a few days later.
Do you know how fast the other driver was going?
I don't. The police are still investigating. I'm sure all that's going to come out. At my glance, though, it looked like they're doing at least double the speed limit.
Yeah, because of the holiday today, we have not heard back from police today, but they have told Global News that their investigation into the crash continues. We know they collected a blood sample from the driver. Have you heard anything about that?
No, that's kind of the big question, and I'm trying to withhold judgment or you know, getting too emotionally involved in it until everything comes out, because it does matter. It's relevant. I know that they took blood samples, and that's not going to lie. So if they were driving under the influence, that will come out.
You are a very active person. You mentioned jiu-jitsu. I know that you're very into that. You even teach it. How much of a factor do you think that is in how well you've held up? Because that was such a huge impact.
I credit a great deal. Jiu-jitsu, I think in multiple ways, has helped me survive that crash and pull through it, and will be one of the main things that gets me back on my feet and back to where I was before, if not coming back even stronger. I would say physically, jiu-jitsu is a strenuous combat sport, so you get tough from doing it. My neck is thicker and stronger than it would have been if I never trained. And beyond just physically, like my jiu-jitsu community, the people from Van Al Jiu-Jitsu and around as well, even not affiliated but still involved in jiu-jitsu in town and elsewhere, they've just given me so much support. They spearheaded a GoFundMe for me. My freezer is full of food because people keep on showing up and bringing more and more. It's hard to think of a single person who hasn't reached out to say, hey, are you okay? Is there anything at all I can do? And I feel like that sort of support really helps people get through tough times such as this.
If there's any pluses from an experience like you're going through, then that would be it, I suppose. David, I wish you a really fast recovery. Don't push yourself. And thank you so much for speaking with us. All the best.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Take
bye.
Care.
David Brune is recovering after his truck was T-boned earlier this month. We reached him in Victoria. In the UK, love hedgehogs. It's just a fact. They love them so much, they worry about them. It's why earlier this week, when a Cheshire resident saw a hoglet curled into a distinctive defensive ball, they leapt into action, capturing the creature and caring for it tenderly until they could get it to a hedgehog rescue group, which promptly informed them they needn't have bothered, because the baby hedgehog was actually a full-grown faux fur pom-pom, likely from a hat. The animal may not have been real, but the instinct to protect the spiky little critter was spot on. Hedgehog numbers are in sharp decline across the UK. So this week, conservation organizations launched a new national hedgehog monitoring program that relies on the shared brain power of AI and human volunteers to get to the bottom of the problem. Hugh Warwick is a spokesperson for the British Hedgehog Preservation Society, one of the groups that's leading the project. We reached him in Oxford, UK.
Hugh, we don't have hedgehogs in the wild in Canada, so help me understand. Are they easy to confuse with a pom-pom?
Now that story is just such a delight. Now, I would say I have had moments when I have been confused as well. I was frequently, in fact, have jumped into fields chasing after hedgehogs, only to discover that they are cowpats, because you're walking along at night, you're carrying a torch, and as you sort of walk and shine your torch, the shadows seem to move. And so, yes, you go, oh, my gosh, a hedgehog, jump over the fence and find out, yes, that hedgehog wasn't going anywhere at all. So I sympathize.
Yeah, it'd be quite an unpleasant surprise to scoop up that so-called hedgehog in your hands, I suppose. So what is it about hedgehogs that means that they are in need of protection at this point?
Okay, so in the United Kingdom, we've got the Western European hedgehog, our species here, Erinaceus europaeus. And the interesting thing with this species is that every time there's a vote or a poll for the nation's favorite nature icon or favorite wild animal, the hedgehog always wins. So that's park that sort of thought there. But we know with quite a degree of robustness that the population has declined by up to 75% just since the year 2000 in some rural landscapes, and in our urban landscape is down by a quarter. Now, the reason why these animals are disappearing and the reason why we need to take action to help them is in part down simply to the way we live. It's down to the fact that we have agriculture, which is doing its best to make a profit, which is understandable, but in doing so needs to control the competitors. And unfortunately, from a hedgehog's point of view, what the farmer sees as competition, the hedgehog sees as food. And so we have that, and we have that loss of food. We also have habitat fragmentation. It's the chopping up of the landscape of the hedgehog into smaller and smaller pieces. Mm-hmm. And so one of the big things we're doing is looking to try and overcome this chopping up of our landscape by opening up corridors between different places.
So you're trying to determine the population, where they're gathering, that sort of thing. I know you have some of that information, but it's not enough. So that's where your new project comes in. How is this supposed to work?
Well, we're setting out arrays of trail cameras, these nighttime motion-sensitive cameras, being set up around the country and in different locations. And they're set up in a very specific way, such that the information gathered from them of hedgehogs moving across the scene as the videos are collected can be put into a clever computer program, which will give us an answer to the number of hedgehogs in that area. Up until now, what we've been able to record is how the population has changed, which is really useful, but it's not an absolute number. What we're doing now, the thing which is slightly different about the National Hedgehog Monitoring Program is that we need help, and we can have help from absolutely anywhere in the world. All you need is access to the internet, because millions of video clips are being pulled in all the time.
So I can be a hedgehog spotter here in Canada?
You know, gosh, yes. I would always love to talk about hedgehogs, but the real drive here is I want to recruit Canadian hedgehog spotters too. Anyway, so the point is, what we're doing, we've got millions of clips of data coming into the National Hedgehog Monitoring Program, and this is where you come in. This is where you and your listeners come in, because we've got this opportunity to get people to log on to the National Hedgehog Monitoring Program and to sift clips, and you get to see, do you think it's a fox? Do you think it's an owl? Do you think it's a cat? Or, blessed be, a hedgehog?
Right. Now, once this information is gathered, once people have contributed what they're sifting through, what do you do with that information in practical terms to potentially improve habitat?
Okay. Well, once we've got very clear ideas of the numbers of hedgehogs in a particular area, when we've identified areas which are doing particularly well, it's a case of identifying what are the key components there which might really be helping hedgehogs, try and replicate them elsewhere. But also what it's doing is giving us something we can repeat year in, year out. This isn't just a one-off. If we can get something a little more robust, one, it gives us an idea of where the problems are lying, Two, the areas which are good indicate and suggest to us what we can do in those areas. But third, and possibly most important, is it might add more weight to our attempts to get better protection for the hedgehog as well.
You mentioned that the Britons identify the hedgehog as their favorite wild creature. You've called it especially cute, and I agree. I mean, when I see pictures or images of hedgehogs, I can't get over how adorable they are. Beyond them being cute, what is it that makes them so special to you?
I say one of the things is quite practical. Hedgehogs don't have a fight or flight response. So most wildlife, when you get close to it, it either bites you or runs away. Fight or flight. The hedgehog, it frowns and then it rolls up into a ball. And what this means is, one, your field work is easier and safer, but also those moments of connection are something particularly precious for me. I've rescued hedgehogs from various places of potential disaster, and they roll up in a ball, you place them down, and then I've lain on the ground opposite them and just waited for them to unroll. And you'll end up with a moment when you get nose to nose, eye to beady eye with this fantastic predator. I mean, this is an amazingly, brilliantly evolved predator. And they are sentient enough so that, I mean, you can pick up slugs and snails and look at them, and there's not really much connection there. But when you get nose to nose with a hedgehog, you will see the hedgehog taking you in, assessing whether you're a threat, and then it will probably pootle off doing snuffly hedgehog things. And those moments of connection are absolutely precious, because they're the moments, I argue, we risk taking that dramatic leap from liking nature to loving it. And as Stephen Jay Gould, the now late writer, said, we will not fight to save anything we do not love.
It has been a real pleasure to speak with you, Hugh. All the best with this project.
Thank you so much, Helen.
Hugh Warwick is a spokesperson for the British Hedgehog Preservation Society. He was in Oxford.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart MacLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
For the past 2 weeks, U.S. college basketball fans have had a chance to see some of the country's best players on display, but they've also had a chance to see some of Canada's rising stars.
Agent hit, and it is, place is going nuts.
And I've been so impressed by her speed. It's a sprinting post player. Look at her run, get all the way back and get in front of Peely after laying it in at the other end.
That's ESPN describing one of the many baskets by Calgary's Yvonne Ejim. The 21-year-old forward plays for the Gonzaga Bulldogs. Tonight, the team will compete in the Sweet 16 for the first time in almost a decade, a moment Miss Ejim has been dreaming of.
I'm so excited. I'm so happy. Definitely like a joyous moment right now for me and my team. I've had so much support coming in from Calgary and from Canada in general, friends, teachers, coaches. I've had so many people reach out and just wish me their support. And I think that's been one of the most rewarding things, just knowing how much I'm still connected to those people back home. Like, it really is like kind of like a heartwarming thing to experience.
That's Yvonne Ejim of the Gonzaga Bulldogs speaking to CBC Calgary's The Eye Opener. Eddie Richardson is the director of basketball at Calgary's Edge School and coached Ms. Ejim when she was a teenager. We reached him in Chicago earlier today.
Eddie, you have to be one of the people that Yvonne is referring to there. What's it feel like to see her credit people like you who've helped bring her to this point?
You know, I'm so grateful and blessed, but it's who she is. You know, she's so unselfish. She's always thinking about her teammates and the other people around her, last to take credit. So it doesn't surprise me one bit. She's so amazing.
What's it been like for you to watch her in these March Madness games?
Oh, it's so good. I actually drove down. I took my kids down to see her live to get into the Sweet 16 last game against Utah. So we were there at Gonzaga in the kennel to watch Coach Lisa and Craig and Jordan and Yvonne play live. It was so surreal for my kids and for me to see her in her element doing her thing. I was so proud.
Are there particular moments from any of the games you've watched that have stood out for you?
I think it's just, again, her unselfishness, where, you know, she supports her teammates even when they're not hitting shots or they're kind of off of their rhythm, but get them back on rhythm before she kind of takes over on the offensive side. So just kind of seeing her continually be who she is in her own skin, what she's so great at, that's kind of what's making me the proudest.
Yeah, beyond that, ability to be a team player, she obviously has got some pretty mad skills. What are they? What makes her so good?
I think it's her angles. She understands the game so well in terms of how to attack the basket, how to attack her opponent. She plays within herself. So her mid-range game, 14 to 16 feet, is so good when she shoots the basketball. She can finish with both hands, great timing. Again, she knows who she is, and I think that's a skill in itself. Yeah, I think she's so talented, and it's awesome to see.
What do you remember of Yvonne in the first days when you were coaching her as a 14-year-old? Did she make an immediate impression on you?
Yes, absolutely. I looked at my two assistants, Hillary and Angela, after one of our practices, and she did something. It was either just catching the ball, ripping it coast to coast and finishing. And we kind of just looked at each other and smiled and laughed. And we said, man, she's going to be special. So I think the very first practice, we knew where she was going to be heading.
Right. So what do you do as a coach when someone's got that much potential and you see it at that age? How do you foster that? How much of that depends on you guys as well?
I think it's a mix of both, right? You have to meet in the middle with the athlete, and the athlete has to understand that they're talented, but they still have a long way to go. And I think with Yvonne, she always knew that she had to get better and better. So she put the extra time in. So us challenging her out of her comfort zone, but also at the same time within her team. So she was always trying to make her team better while she was actually developing her skills. So it was a perfect mix.
You keep in touch with her, I understand. Tell me a little bit about the conversations that you have.
Yeah, you know, she's got so much support and so many people. So ours is kind of a big brother, little sister, just checking in on her, asking her about her game, what she needs help with, if she needs help with anything, keeping it light. But just knowing, letting her know how supportive and how big of a deal this is. And not just because she's being successful, but, you know, even in her first years when she was just getting down there, of what she means to our city and our country, and what she's doing to help grow the game, because she has no idea how the little girls and girls in our program are looking at her, and boys, and saying, oh my gosh, like, that's somebody to look up to. So I think just reminding her how special she is and how much support she has and that we're cheering her on.
Yeah, you mentioned her as a player in Canada. She has been playing with the Canadian Olympic team. What do you think it would mean to her to actually represent Canada on that level?
It's going to be great. I think, again, she can do anything she wants. She just has that willpower and the willingness to work to get what she wants to do. So I think that would be the icing on the cake for her to represent Canada in Paris for the Games.
This seems to be a moment for the WNBA. I mean, women's basketball in general seems to have really sparked people's passions. Maybe people didn't always pay attention to it. So she potentially could have a WNBA future ahead of her, I guess, after her fifth year of college basketball ahead. Do you think that's in her future?
If she wants it to be, I think she definitely can be. She's in pre-med right now. Like, she is such an amazing student athlete and understands her future. And I think if that's something she wanted to do, she could definitely pursue it, for sure.
You say she's in pre-med. Is that her goal, do you think, to be a doctor?
Yes, absolutely. She's always wanted to do that, even since she was young. And you know, to do that as a student athlete in the NCAA is mind-blowing. So, again, it just shows how much work ethic she has and what she does, you know, on and off the court.
Yeah. So when Yvonne and the Bulldogs face off against number one ranked Texas, where will you be?
Oh, I'm in Chicago right now coaching the next generation up, but I'm going to be sitting. Our game's going to end and we're going to be right in front of the TV and I'll be watching, screaming at the TV.
Give me your best guess. Can she and the Bulldogs go all the way?
I think they can. If they continue to shoot the ball well and take care of their turnovers, I think they'll be fine. I think they got a shot. That's for sure.
Eddie, it's really nice to talk with you. Thanks so much for taking the time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Eddie Richardson is the director of basketball at Calgary's Edge School and Yvonne Ejim's former coach. We reached him in Chicago earlier today. Louis Gossett Jr. wasn't just a groundbreaking actor, he was also an exceptional one, able to portray quiet nuance and deep emotion in equal measure. Whether as a drill sergeant in An Officer and a Gentleman or the cunning fiddler in Roots, the Oscar and Emmy-nominated winning actor built layered, complex, and captivating characters on screen. Mr. Gossett Jr. died today. He was 87. In an industry seeped in racism, Mr. Gossett Jr. forged a path, finding unique characters and vowing to never play the same role twice. But it wasn't easy. In 2015, he appeared in the CBC TV adaptation of Lawrence Hill's acclaimed novel, The Book of Negroes. At the time, he told Q guest host Pia Chattopadhyay about the stark contrast between his childhood in Brooklyn and his arrival in Hollywood.
That's how I was raised, first generation North. My parents were very worried because they were last generation South. Mm. So I have a combination of both. Mm. I read about what was happening in the South, but I was not touched by any kind of racism until I was an established actor in California in 1966.
That was your first taste of it?
First real taste of it.
What happened?
I showed up as the star of the first movie of the week at Universal, and I was in the Beverly Hills Hotel, and they told me I had a rental car waiting for me. And I went to 20 minutes down the road to get the rental car, and it was one of those Ford Fairlane Galaxy 500s, convertible, egg cream white, red interior, and I turned on some Sam Cooke music, and that 20-minute ride from that place to the hotel took 4.5 hours. I met every policeman on the block. I didn't know what they were talking about. And then it went from there. They had no concept of anybody my color being a star, unless we were an athlete or a dealer. But now it's a different ballgame.
Yes, somewhat of a different ballgame.
Somewhat of a different one.
And then you go on to star in An Officer and a Gentleman.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And you earn an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor for that role. You make history. You're the first African-American to win that award. I think the third black person to ever win.
Hattie, Sidney, and myself.
Yeah. What's that moment mean to you?
Oh, there was no room in the mind to conceive. I was thinking of... Before they said my name, and I almost didn't really hear my name, top five. That's pretty cool stuff, you know, top five. So for some reason, I get hit in the ribs. And they said your name. I said, no. They said, get up there. Getting recognition globally puts something in your throat. It makes your throat choke a little bit. And it's just an overwhelming thing to see everybody shaking your hand and taking pictures. The reality... It took about a year for me to get a proper job and or get proper salaries, like maybe my buddy Paul Newman would get, or another friend, Marlon Brando, or the late James Dean, or those guys I grew up with. They got theirs quick. Mm. So I guess I might have had a little resentment with that because...
Yeah. Why do you think you didn't get them quick?
Nobody's ready for me to have won that Oscar. So there was no projects properly, you know. But it's God's time. It's not my time or your time. That's Alex Haley's mom said the same thing. God may not be there when you want him, but he's always there on time.
From 2015, that's Louis Gossett Jr. speaking with guest host Pia Chattopadhyay on CBC's Q. The Oscar-winning actor died today. He was 87 years old. Scientists are warning that after nearly 80 years, an interstellar zombie is about to return to life. The zombie in question is a nova, which is basically a burned-out star. It's called T. Corona Borealis, and the warnings are of the don't-miss-it variety. Amateur observers are already craning their telescopes for a glimpse of the once-in-a-generation moment when the thing goes from basically invisible to lighting up the sky. And Brad Schaefer says they won't have long to wait. Professor Schaefer teaches astronomy at the University of Louisiana. We reached him in Tucson, Arizona. Professor Schaefer, what are you expecting to see when T. Corona Borealis reignites?
Oh, I'll be going outside looking up. Anyone can do it. And up there in the constellation Corona Borealis, halfway between Bootes and Hercules, there will be this new star. It'll be the brightest nova of our generation and prior generations, too. And it's just one big hellfire up there in the sky shining down. It's far away, so we don't have to worry.
So what is going to be happening that actually produces all this light? What's the phenomenon?
Well, it's a nova. T. Corona Borealis, which is also called T. Cor Bor for short. T. Cor Bor is a nova. It goes off roughly every 80 years, and the 80-year time span is now up, and it should be going off any time now. We actually have some harbingers of this. So there's a thing, well, we would call the pre-eruption dip, which the eruption back in 1946 went off just as the bottom of this pre-eruption dip, and we're at the bottom of the pre-eruption dip. The thing should be going off. So it's likely to happen anytime between now and say, the end of summer. It could go up tonight.
You called this hellfire. What's fueling it?
A nova is where you have two stars in very close orbit around each other. One of the stars is, in the case of T. Cor Bor, it's a red giant star. Okay, fair enough. It's orbiting around a white dwarf, and the orbit is so tight that matter falls off regularly, steadily falls off of the red giant, falls off onto the white dwarf, where it accumulates. When you've accumulated enough matter, the temperature at the base of this zone of accreted matter on the very surface of the white dwarf gets so hotter and hotter and hotter, and it reaches the point where you have the kindling temperature of hydrogen. That's really hot, by the way. Once that thermonuclear reactions start, that heats up more hydrogen, which makes more burning, which makes for more heating up, which makes for more burning. It's a runaway, and it's an explosion. That's what we see. So it takes a while for this hydrogen that's spilling over onto the white dwarf. It takes a while for that to get piled high enough and deep enough that the temperature gets to the kindling temperature of hydrogen. Well, in the case of T. Cor Bor, it takes roughly 80 years to accumulate. And once the explosion happens, that's what we see up there. And, hey, these fireballs of the hydrogen bomb in the middle, that comes under the word hellfire. That's perfectly fine.
Is it true that the last appearance had some link to a famous burlesque star?
Oh, yes. Well, back in its 1866 eruption, the people of the time gave it the name the Blaze Star because it was blazing up in the skies. Fair enough. And then come 1946, it went off again. Okay. And what happened was a West Virginia farm girl heard about this, and she went off to the big city, and she realized she had to have a stage name, and because the stage name, that way her mother back home wouldn't know, or at least for a while. And so the name she chose for herself was Blaze Star, and that her last name was S-T-A-R-R. But if the discovery in 1946 can even get down to the level of a West Virginia farm girl, it seeps into the consciousness of everyone here. And I think the same thing's going to happen when the Blaze Star goes up again, within a few months here.
Yeah, I mean, your enthusiasm is apparent, and obviously a lot of people love looking up at the sky. But beyond kind of the excitement of seeing this hydrogen reaction, is there some science that you're hoping will come out of this reappearance?
Oh, yes, of course. We've been waiting 80 years to find out. There are a variety of mysteries going on with Tichor Bohr in particular. There's some weird things that it's been doing, like that pre-eruption dip that I just mentioned. What's going on with that? But one of the grand challenge problems in astrophysics goes by the name or the rubric of the Type 1A supernova progenitor, which means it's a what type of star creates supernova, the most famous of them, the Type 1A supernova. And this has been a controversy for a long time, back and forth. And Tichor Bohr has been one of the premier candidates for being a Type 1A supernova progenitor. And with this upcoming eruption of Tichor Bohr, we can actually check out whether it will become a Type 1A supernova.
I gather the last time it showed, one of the big experts actually missed the show.
Leslie Peltier, one of the greatest of all time for visual observers, amateur astronomers like me. And he was the one who recognized and discovered this pre-eruption dip I mentioned. And he's the one who put out this circular saying, Tichor Bohr is going to blow any moment now, and it did. Oh, but in one of these stories I learned back in high school, what he did was, his alarm clock went off at 2:30 in the morning and he looked outside, and it was incredibly cold, and he decided to go back to bed. And so the one night when Tichor Bohr goes up, he missed it. And reading the story that he wrote, it was full of pathos, and there was no more love lost between them after Tichor Bohr had stood him up.
Oh, dear. Well, listen, between the upcoming solar eclipse and Tichor Bohr, we've got a lot of look to look forward to in the skies. Thank you very much for telling us about all of this.
Okey-dokey. Bye-bye, then.
Brad Schaefer is a professor emeritus at Louisiana State University. We reached him in Tucson, Arizona. You know that smell babies have? No, the good one. The one you inhale deeply while you're holding them. So deeply you get lightheaded. I mean, I can control it, and I definitely will not snorkel your infant like a truffle pig if I get the opportunity, but it's a very powerful smell. And researchers in Germany wanted to explore it more deeply. So they collected the scents of 18 children under 3 years old and ran them through a science machine to help determine its chemical components. They also employed the nose services of an expert human smeller. And now we have scientific evidence that young children smell like flowers, soap, and a hint of violet. This scent is believed to spur parental affection. It's not yet clear, though, what explains the smells of children as they grow older. The same researchers determined that puberty brings out a rather different, less affection-generating bouquet, with notes of cheese, goat, and urine, but also some sandalwood, so there's that. It's nothing that can't be made worse by a liberally applied fog of Axe body spray. And one of the co-authors of the study did postulate that possibly the reason teenagers become smellier is that it helps them foster new independence, which is something. And I suppose we should thank goodness for smell mercies. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
You can also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Helen Mann. Thank you for listening.
And I'm Lisa Brin-Rundle.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.